The recording is on.
Very good. So again, for the sake of this being posted on our website, my name is Bruce Lees, president of APA Division 50, Society of Addiction Psychology, and this presentation is Ethics for Addiction Psychologists, one credit of what will be eventually two credits when you join us on part two. So welcome, everybody. There's over 20 people on the line. There's a lot of work that we need to do for starters, so I want to just draw your attention to the slide show that is available on a PDF. Mark has sent that to everybody, and you should have a handout with my slides, and it says Ethics for Addiction Psychologist there, so clinical conference call. And you'll also see he also sent out separately the guide entitled Ethical Principles of Psychologists and Code of Conduct. If you don't have the second one, you can absolutely just get online and go to apa.org, type in Ethical Principles of Psychologists, PDF, and you will get a copy of that. I'm going to use both handouts and direct you to where to where my lecture is coming from. So starting with our slides, I have changed the workshop objectives just a little bit because we only have an hour. So those of you who are taking credit, and even the rest of you who aren't, I want to highlight that at the end of our conversation today, you should all be able to list at least one major ethical principle and one standard for psychologists, ethical standard, and be able to apply these to the practice of addiction psychology, and that'll become more clear in a few moments. You should, at the end of this, be able to explain at least two basic behavioral ethics constructs. We're going to be talking both about ethical principles and standards, but also about behavioral ethics. And from my perspective, that is the exciting part of studying ethics, and I'll talk about that in great detail as time permits. And then finally, I hope you're able to describe at least one strategy for increasing your own likelihood of making ethical decisions. I want to say here that my interest and passion for behavioral ethics includes my knowledge that all of us on this line today who are listening and me talking, hold the belief that we're highly ethical people. Many, many people just take ethics courses because they are mandated. The reason why they take them as mandates instead of out of great, great interest is I would suggest that nobody on the call would say, well, I'm unethical. There's a really very deep and interesting database, research base for the study of behavioral ethics. An example of one little study that's kind of interesting is that when you take a group of people that works closely together and you ask them to rate themselves as either more ethical than the rest, equally ethical, or less ethical than the rest of the group, when you do the math and you get the results back, on whole, way more than 100. There's way more than 100% of people saying I'm more ethical. So nobody says I'm less ethical, and a few people say I'm equally ethical. But most people rate themselves as highly ethical, which is why most people groan when they're told you got to take an ethics workshop or course or conference like this. So what I want to argue today is that every one of us on the line has the vulnerabilities that lead us to make even tiny ethical errors as we go through our day of practice or research. So nobody on this call is 100% ethical all the time. I just wrote up a few examples of the kinds of problems that could lead us to act unethically in tiny, tiny ways. Working in a medication-assisted treatment program and being asked by the physician what you think the patient should get in terms of the prescription strength of even an antidepressant. If you're in an environment where they expect the psychologist to quickly answer medication recommendations, many psychologists will talk like a physician and say, well, I think I think that patient ought to be on an SSRI, which really, really comes close to crossing that boundary of ethical versus unethical. Then we face, you know, questionable circumstances, like you find out from one client or patient you see that another one who they saw in the waiting room is their dealer, and you're sitting in the room with the person who you know to be a dealer of illicit drugs, and you have the knowledge in your head that that's the case, and you have to struggle with that and decide what you do with that and how you deal with that for the safety of your own client and for the safety of society. So we're faced with very difficult and challenging ethical dilemmas as addiction psychologists that other psychologists may be faced with, but they don't realize it because they may not be consciously treating people with addictions. They may be treating them and not even know they're treating people with addictions. So if you look at the next slide, there are two ways to think about ethics. One is to look at the content of ethics. In my right hand, I'm holding the slides and reading off of them. In my left hand, I'm looking at the APA publication, Ethical Principles of Psychologists and Code of Conduct. These ethical principles I'm looking at here contain content. They are most involved with describing, listing, explaining the principles and the standards and the codes that psychologists are expected to live up to. So that's content. The process of thinking and acting ethically is the whole decision-making process, the cognitive and behavioral dynamics that go into decision-making. That's where behavioral ethics comes in, and again, that's really where my passion is. How do we make, faced with a potential ethical situation or dilemma or circumstance where we could make an ethical or unethical decision, no matter how big or small, how does our mind work? Both content and process are extremely important, and both should certainly be considered when studying ethics. So in this little teeny tiny workshop or conference call, I'm going to try to go as quickly as I can to talk about both content and process. And those who take part two will get to spend more time talking about it. So, you know, don't groan. Please don't groan. But take a look at this, Ethical Principles of Psychologists and Code of Conduct. And again, if you didn't get the email with it attached, you can find it on APA.org and certainly just look for Ethical Principles. The content of ethical decision-making involving those principles, standards, and codes are similar to the other disciplines involved in mental health care, that, you know, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, certified counselors. Each of those areas has a code of ethical conduct or some version of it. And so ours looks a whole lot like others, probably way more comprehensive, I'd argue. But the common themes on the next slide that you will find if you look across the behavioral health spectrum at all the ethics talks, the common themes all involve, you know, client-patient welfare, practicing within the scope of your competencies, avoiding harm and exploitation, protecting confidentiality and privacy, acting responsibly, that stuff, striving for aspirational practice, and I'll talk about that. But here's where the juicy part comes in, from my perspective. Every one of the approximately 24 people on this call has some interest in addiction treatment, and I argue right off the bat here, as you can hear, I argue that we are faced with unique aspects of addictive behaviors and substance use disorders. We're faced with challenges that generalists probably never, they may be faced with them and they may not even know it. Of course, you all know that there's a large number of people treating people with depression and anxiety that have underlying addictions, and those are not recognized or acknowledged. But the unique features of addiction treatment, as you can see from the slide I have provided, and these are just some, you know, addictions are really complex. As we all know, people with addictions are an extremely heterogeneous group in every single way. You know, some Some have mood disorders, some don't. Some have anxiety disorders, some don't. Some have major thought disorders, some don't. Some are old, some are young, some are rich, some are poor. We're dealing with an extremely heterogeneous group, and on top of that, we're talking about people at all different stages of readiness to change, using all different kinds of substances and behaviors as compensatory strategies to deal with their suffering. So addictions are complex, and so some of the ethical issues that we face are accordingly complex. And as I'm implying from that first point, bullet point, you know, no two people with addictions are exactly alike with the same needs and manifestations. So we can't just apply a single protocol to somebody because they come in with the chief complaint of an addictive behavior or a substance use disorder because of coexisting pathology, not just psychological, but medical pathologies, medical illnesses. We really need to know a lot about people before we can really customize the treatment they need. And if we don't do that, we're coming way too close to less than fully ethical behavior. And that falls into the category of competency or not acting in the most competent fashion. Here's a big one, as you can see from this slide. Addictions are chronic, and you don't stop the medication or the treatment of diabetes because the patient is doing well, and you really need to think twice before saying goodbye permanently to anyone who's got a history of addictions. I'm not saying that they don't terminate therapy. I'm saying, ethically, it's important to really think about it before you say goodbye to somebody. And that poses its own unique set of problems that I hope I have some time to talk about. Here, the next few are biggies. The next three. I don't know anybody who goes, wow, that person has major depressive disorder. Stay away from them. You can't trust those people. Those people are losers. Or, wow, somebody with a flying phobia. Don't associate with them. They're losers. They live under a bridge. But the stigma associated with addictive behaviors, the potential for risk to oneself, to others, that's the stuff that you and I face that puts us in difficult positions that rumble pretty close to ethical issues, if not introduce completely ethical issues. And how about the fact that most substances that are used for altering consciousness that become addictive are still illegal, even though in multiple states you can now buy and smoke and chew and swallow marijuana. The coexisting conditions, the involvement in other therapeutic activities, you don't get a lot of people with depression and anxiety that are going to world-renowned other therapeutic activities. So people we see in addictions, they're visiting therapy groups that don't involve us. They're going to 12-step programs. These all introduce, if you look later, we'll take a look at the last page of ethical principles or the last section, and you'll see that there are pretty significant guidelines for thinking about providing care to a person who's getting it elsewhere. And, you will find yourself more likely providing care to somebody who's in smart recovery or a 12-step program or in some kind of therapy group. There is somebody who hasn't muted their phone yet, and they're ruffling around. So if you would please put your phone on mute, that'd be terrific. Thank you. Somebody's shuffling papers. So that slide is the slide that should intrigue you. The unique features of addiction treatment, I even put it in there twice because as I talk about cases, I really want to remind us all that the people we take care of, the people we study in our research, they don't look as homogeneous as some other groups look who have certain psychological disorders. So given that, let's peek at the next couple of slides. Given that we treat a unique population, let's look at what are some of the things you need to know as an addiction psychologist. It's really important that you know the ethical standards. You know, they they've been around a while. You can see if you look at page 2, starting in 1953, they've been revised 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, a dozen, more than a dozen times. And most recently, they've been revised in 2016. So ethical standards, if you go in with a positive attitude, it's pretty intriguing. Ethical standards, as written by the American Psychological, by members of the American Psychological Association, the word aspirational is used repeatedly, and you know, it is aspirational. We are really encouraged as we read ethical principles to realize what an important role we play in society and how important it is that we serve to strengthen those who suffer and struggle and to make society better. So I like to think positively when I look through these instead of thinking, oh gosh, I really have to read these again. And I do think positively. But what else do you need to know about addiction if you're an addiction psychologist? What else do you need to know about ethics? For sure, there are federal and local laws that regard substance use. It is important to find out what is what in your jurisdiction, what laws are relevant. Dr. Budney, who's on the line, can tell you about all kinds of marijuana-related things, and certainly of most interest lately is how the country is changing in its view of marijuana use, with certain states legalizing and the federal government saying, heck no, we're not changing our position. So that creates this complex environment. You know, there are certain federal regs regarding confidentiality, CFR 42. Become familiar with these. Confidentiality, records regarding confidentiality, and I'm looking at the next slide now. Addiction psychologists moving away from the law. Like I said earlier, participation in groups and the potential for self-harm and, oh, the involvement of families with people with addictions. The likelihood, I don't get a lot of calls from families that say, you know, my nephew suffers from fear of snakes or from generalized anxiety, can you help him? But I sure get a lot of calls saying, my nephew, son, daughter, grandmother, you know, has an addiction and we want to get her into treatment and we don't know how. So getting all the people that get involved, that's another thing that is important to know about as you move into ethics as an addiction psychologist. Interprofessional collaboration. I work in an environment and consult in an environment where they're doing medication-assisted therapy. All of a sudden, us psychologists are hanging around a bunch of physicians who are prescribing medications like Suboxone, methadone, where there are constantly physicians, social workers, nurses right next to us saying, gee, doc, to the psychologist, what do you think we ought to do? And what do you think the best dose is? And what do you do in a case like this? So it's really big changes with medication-assisted therapy, and that influences the scope of practice, and, of course, HIPAA is important. So let's peek at the ethical principles of psychologists and the code of conduct real quick. It's worth our attention. Divided into a few parts. The introduction is nice and brief. It talks about the intent and the organization and the procedural considerations. I hope you have a copy of it or you have it on your computer. Flip through it a little bit. The preamble is really a nice, like I said, aspirational statement about the importance of psychologists in this world, in this sometimes crazy mixed up world, and how we are there to provide wisdom and care and good sense, and ethics is a big part of good sense. And the principles, the aspirational goals are like the preamble. They're aspirational, the general principles, and then specific standards. The specific standards are what most of this document is about, and they clearly, beyond a shadow of a doubt, as I'll get to soon, there are so many implications for addiction psychology, and I'm going to really want to pay attention to that. So let's just jump over to the principles. There are A through E, like principle A, beneficence and malfeasance. Take a look at that slide. Psychologists, you know, we're told in these principles that psychologists benefit those with whom they work and take care and do no harm. You know, of course, like, isn't that sensible? I mean, don't we all know that? Sure we do. But think about the history of addiction treatment and how normal it was to make confrontation a major part of addiction treatment, saying to somebody, you know, you're an addict. Look what you're doing to your family. You know, how can you do this? In the olden days, that was acceptable, and it was not very beneficent, and it was malfeasance to lay blame and wag the finger at people with addictions. It's not helpful, and it results in bad outcomes. But again, what I'm doing here and looking at these principles like beneficence and malfeasance, every one of these bullet points is relevant to addiction treatment because we probably are more at risk of being confronted if we're seeing people that are harming themselves right before our eyes. There's also the issue of abandonment. How many programs say you can't come here if you're high? Well, what if you've got a strong therapeutic relationship with somebody and they show up at your clinic high and they've relapsed and they're not going to turn the corner, and you know the rule at your institution, your agency is, you know, we don't see people who come in high. You know, we're more at risk for abandonment. Safeguarding the welfare and rights of those with whom we interact. You know, well-meaning people who are in the person's life safeguard the welfare and rights of those with whom they interact. Well-meaning people want to step in and help us. Family members want to call and say, you know, they're doing bad things. You got to know about this. There are organizational demands that introduce conflicts between the obligations or concerns that we have. So there is potential. And the last one, be aware of the possible effect of our own physical and mental health. You know, we're at risk for burnout as addiction psychologists. And that's a mental health problem. It isn't a hospitalizable one, but when we get burned out, you know, we're at risk of violating that one. You know, I'm tired. I hear every day, you know, you're destroying your life. So I'm not going to do this for every one of them, but each and every one of these bullet points, for beneficence and malfeasance, for fidelity and responsibility, for integrity, for justice, for respect for people's rights and dignity, those are the basic principles. All of those have special cases that we see, people in circumstances where we run close to the edge. I'll just grab another one real quick. Fidelity and responsibility. Be aware of professional and scientific responsibilities to society and the community. What do we do if we find out that somebody's driving under the influence? As psychologists, we have a responsibility to our client, but also to the community. If we know someone drives under the influence, ethically, what are we allowed to do? We know that, you know, somebody calls us drunk and says, oh, I'm going to be driving to your office in a few minutes, and they hang up, and you know they're about to get in their car under the influence and drive 2,000 pounds of steel around town to get to us. What if you find out somebody's selling to minors? You know, this is the fidelity and responsibility stuff. We're responsible to society, and yet we hear things that we can't control that threaten society. And I could go on and on. You know, integrity, these expensive treatment mills that promise the world and certainly can't deliver the world. And we may get a job in one of those and not realize what we're facing. I will stop for questions there real quick. What I've done is given you a big old introduction and talked to you about the importance and value of the content of ethical principles, but specifically talked about a few of the principles and how we, as addiction psychologists, face clinical circumstances that demand our attention in a way that might be different from dealing with people with other disorders. So I'd be interested in any questions or comments, and we have 28 minutes left, so I want to make sure I don't get too distracted. So, anyone so far? Is somebody say I'm still on the line, so I don't have that thing where I'm talking, my cell phone hung up on me and I've been talking to dead air for half an hour.
I hear you.
You're doing great.
I hear you, Bruce. This is Berkshire.
All right.
Tom Horvath.
Yes, sir.
I feel sorry for psychologists who work within systems. I run my own practice, so I set the rules, and we follow the APA ethical principles. But I know a lot of psychologists who are stuck in the middle in treatment facilities that are, frankly, abusive of clients and abusive of ethical principles. And maybe that's a point worth talking about, is how they manage that.
Absolutely, and I have very strong feelings about that. As I just forwarded about 2 weeks ago, one of the articles in the New York Times series that shows how much fraud and deceit exists in some of the major substance use disorder treatment mills, and I choose not to describe what happens to my blood pressure when I'm watching the news and that guy with the stethoscope around his neck comes on and says, if you know somebody who has an addiction, get them treatment, just call us and we'll find you, you know, we'll find you an addiction treatment center. And the implication is that, you know, you're a mess, we'll solve your problem, you know, we're a clearinghouse for the best. And something tells me that the providers that adhere most to empirically supported treatments and evidence-based practice are not in that network of people. I don't know if anyone has seen that advertisement with the guy with the scrubs and the white coat, and he's probably about 30. And you know, it's just people are being directed to services that are unscrupulous. And for more data on that, take a look at the New York Times series that describes some very disturbing stuff. I think, Tom, that's what you're talking about, and the people who mean good who find themselves working there.
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yes.
So thank you for raising that. So everybody, let's not delay a moment more. I'm glad I'm not talking to dead air. Once we get past in this this booklet, this guide, this APA published resource that we have in our hands, me and my left hand here. I'm counting the pages. We got a 17 pages with the back cover. If you look at this again, interesting stuff. This is still the content: resolving ethical issues, competence, human relations, privacy, confidentiality. These are the actual standards beyond the general principles. And boy, do they have implications for what we do. You know, I hate to admit it, but I have seen, I'm looking at resolving ethical issues right now on page 4 of that guide. And I'm looking at standard number 1, 1.03, conflicts between ethics and organizational demands. And Dr. Tom Horvath, that's what you're talking about. You go to school for 4, 5, 6 years and get your PhD, and you learn empirically supported treatments, and you're fresh out of graduate school, and you love treating people with addictive behaviors and substance use disorders. And what do you see in front of you? You see that you've been hired by an organization I don't want to get into detail, but let's just say the day isn't filled with empirically supported treatments. In fact, there are a few hours where you get to lay by the pool, and I don't recall any empirically supported treatment that provides some of the things you might see if you're hired by an organization that doesn't provide empirically supported treatment. And you know what? On the way more well-meaning side of things, I am a huge proponent of medication assisted treatment. The data is good for it, and our role in it as psychologists with expertise in cognitive and behavioral and family treatment, it's just such a good environment. It's a rich environment for us psychologists, this medication-assisted treatment stuff. And yet, I'm in one at the University of Kansas, and I will not name the places I'm consulting around the country, helping them with their medication-assisted treatment programs, but they don't really understand that we are not physicians who prescribe, and when they ask us our opinions, I'm not even remotely excited about knowing doses and stuff like that, but a lot of my colleagues are, and not only are we supposed to avoid those conflicts and state clearly, you know, I'm not a physician, I can't answer that, but we're also supposed to report after we talk directly to our colleagues who may be acting in violation of ethical standards. We're supposed to do something when we see our colleagues acting in ways that don't appear ethical. And boy, I've just seen so many physicians, so many psychologists who woke up one day and said, I think I've learned enough about the medication to start advising. And they mean well, and they may be correct 90% of the time, but what happens in that 10% where they're not, or even if they're right all the time, it's not ethical to give advice about medication. So drawing that line clearly may be easy for some of us, but certainly the decision about whether to report or to go up, I have had peers who are talking medications, and I just don't want to get in the fight with them. And I say fight not because I would fight, but boy, they'd probably be insulted if I said, are we supposed to be doing that? So that's something to think about. Resolving ethical issues, that is ethical standard number one. And we're supposed to do something about violations. And how courageous is any of us to go out on that limb? Competence. Man, there's a lot of complexity to addiction. There's chemical effects of drugs, and there's legal and behavioral and cognitive. And there's a lot of competency. There's a lot of competence that is recommended if you're going to be treating people with addictions. So people who treat addiction should know stuff. It's a specialized area, and it is at the very least an area where we should at least have some proficiency, even if not specialty. And yet, as we all know, there's very little training in graduate school in addiction or substance use disorder treatment. I teach one course. It's an elective at the university, and I'm among the minority in the United States of America at graduate schools. There aren't enough addiction courses. So the whole idea that people are treating addictions without us training people to treat addictions, we're creating an incompetency that's unfortunate, to say the very least. Here, let's talk about human relations. Again, I want you to find the APA principles and code of conduct to be riveting because of what we do. This human relations thing, number three, what about stigma? I got a question for you, a hypothetical. What do you do about the fact that some of your, you know, John Kelly teaches us not to talk dirty to our patients, our clients. Don't say they're dirty urines. Don't call them addicts. Don't call them alcoholics. And I happen to agree with John. But, you know, human relations, what about the fact that many people with addictions or substance use disorders, they relate to that. They want to be called, my name is Bruce and I am an alcoholic. My name is Bruce and I am a coke addict. That's what I'm taught to say in certain environments. And yet, we're kind of, there's this dilemma. It's stigmatizing. And where do we say it? Where do we not say it? And that's an ethical issue. Privacy and confidentiality issues. I don't know about you. I don't know about you, but I'm always challenged with, would you see my grandson? Or how's my son doing in counseling and therapy for his internet gaming disorder or his gambling disorder. How's my son doing? Well, Mrs. Smith, your son is 40. I'm really not allowed to tell you how he's doing, even though you referred him to me. And I'm not even allowed to tell you I see him. So that privacy and confidentiality, I don't get calls saying, how's my nephew with a phobia doing? But I do get a lot of calls with people who are concerned about their loved ones with addictions who may have been part of therapy for a few visits. Tom, again, back to your question about people who end up working for less than fully ethical programs, just the advertising that we hear about some of these mills, very concerning. And it'd be hard to know that you're not supposed to guarantee anything and see your own program, your own agency on TV implying that you'll kick the habit if you come to our facility. And heck, I work there, and we're not supposed to be advertising that we guarantee results. And, you know, just kind of flip through the rest of them. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, all important stuff. Record keeping and fees. I'm going to do this. The next slide, record keeping and fees. What do you do if you're seeing somebody for a 45-minute slot and at around 36 minutes, which is 2 minutes short of a 37,908.34 slot billing for therapy? They say, you know, I'm kind of wiped out. That's been helpful. I'm leaving now. Well, do you charge them for 45 minutes? So stuff like that, there are more idiosyncratic behaviors with people with addictions than there are with more homogeneous psychological problems. So even something like, you know, how do you bill when somebody is, maybe you realize they're really not getting it today, and do I do the whole session just because I want to bill 90834? And then let's just jump down to 10. If you look at standard 10 in the APA guide, that's on therapy, and it talks about informed consent, family and couples and group and termination, all stuff that has to do with the work we do. We're going to shift over to the process of ethical decision-making here in a moment. We have about 15 minutes, and the part two of this is going to be for those who wish to join us when we get that all set up. Part two is going to be in the very near future, and that's where we're going to go into real specific cases and discussions, I'm thinking. But anything about these categories of standards, hopefully I've whetted your appetite for this guide that I think many people prefer not to study, though it should be fascinating to us as addiction psychologists. Questions, opinions, statements, challenges, anything? Well, hopefully everyone's quiet because you're riveted and not because you're snoring, but let's go on. I think you're probably interested. Okay, this is juicy stuff now. The process of ethical decision-making. Boy, if you want to really, really find some of the most interesting stuff in psychology, look at the process of ethical decision-making. In a book called Blind Spots by Bazerman and Ten Brunsel, you get a couple of hundred pages about the process of decision-making. And as the title suggests, the blind spots, you know, traditional ethical literature kind of depends on this idea that, you know, ethics is linear. I make you aware of moral processes on this little conference call. You learn how to have good moral judgment. This is on one slide. You have good moral intention and you take good moral action. It ain't the way it goes. We don't think that way when we violate ethics. The worst case scenario, of course, is sleeping with a patient or a client, and that's not, we won't pay very much attention to that, but even in that case, when you look at ethics, it's important to look at the temporal process of ethical decision-making. Put really simply, when you're talking about ethics, there's before an ethical decision is made, there's during the decision, and then there's after the decision. And us humans, generally, before we make an ethical decision, the mode we're in is what we should do. You know, of course I shouldn't sleep with patients, just as an example. Of course I shouldn't. But, you know, if I make that horrible decision to sleep with a patient, it's not because I'm thinking I shouldn't do it, but I'm going to. It's more like, you know, this is different. There's a justification here. You know, there's a psychologist here in Kansas City. I won't give any details. It's probably been in the news and everything years ago. Who, you know, got in a little bit of hot water because they slept with a patient and, you know, and talking about it to various parties and getting into the press. You know, they were soulmates. You know, this person knew they were soulmates. And so during the decision-making process, it's almost like we're blind to morality. Before, of course, we know no psychologist should sleep with a patient. Of course we know we shouldn't get angry at a patient with an addiction. Of course we know we shouldn't fire somebody or confront them vigorously because they've used again. We know these things before, and our right mind tells us don't do it. If we do something unethical, again, it can be a blind spot, like the title of the book. Rarely is it, I know it's wrong and I'm going to do it anyway. And then afterwards, most people will justify what they did and say, you know, it wasn't that. It wasn't the moral issue. It was love or something. So I'm looking at the next slide. Despite all we know about ethical behavior, we all cross ethical lines. We cross those lines. You know, when somebody says to you, well, have you been addicted? Have you ever had a problem? You know, if we answer it in the affirmative, because we have, that's not unethical, but it is a boundary crossing. It's not a boundary violation, which is unethical. It's crossing. So, you know, we come close to the rails. You know, if you have spent 37 minutes with a client and you have a hot date with your significant other that night, and you promised you'd be out on time, and you think now would be a good time to close because you'll get to go out on a date with your honey, there's a chance you'll act unethically and bill for 90834. It's 45 minutes of therapy. So we do that stuff. Let me tell you this, because I want to make sure I cover our final objective well before this call is over. All of us on the call, the two dozen of us that are on the call, we would be well served to be really honest with ourselves and say, when do I cross those or come really dangerously close to those lines, those ethical lines? If the research is correct, and I would predict I'm more ethical than a lot of people and at least as ethical as them, and if the research is correct that we exaggerate how ethical we are when we fail to look at our minor violations, all of us should really take a good hard look at ourselves and say, when do I spend a session not delivering empirically supported treatment because I'm not in the mood? This is my favorite patient, and we're having a nice conversation, and I can call it maintenance. So despite all we know about ethical behavior, we cross those lines. And I think I've listed a few of those. Spending a little less time, assigning. Here's one, everybody, to think about. You're taking care of Joe. Joe has just been a terrific patient, and Joe had an alcohol use disorder, severe. And it's been 6 months, and Joe is completely abstinent for all of those months, and he attributes abstinence to your empirically supported treatment and the quality of your relationship. And Joe says, I don't know what I would do without you. It's so tempting to drink again, but your empirically supported treatment is worth its weight in gold. Thank you. But the insurance company doesn't cover Joe's treatment because he no longer has the symptoms. He doesn't even have the two symptoms of mild alcohol use disorder. Do you just not put the do you lie about the diagnosis and act unethically and say, oh, he's got alcohol use disorder? I don't think insurance companies pay for a history of a disorder. You know, if a patient has a broken ankle, you can't see him 5 years later and say, I'm still seeing him for the history of the broken ankle. So we're seeing people with chronic problems, chronic illnesses, if you want to call them an illness or a disorder or whatever. We're seeing these people for disorders, and when they're better, they're like diabetes patients. They still need care. They still need their prescription, even when their blood sugar levels, their hemoglobin A1C is normal. They still have diabetes, but we don't get that. We don't get that kind of margin there. So we have to lie if we're going to get insurance for taking care of somebody that's been symptom-free for 6 months to help them prevent relapse. Very complicated. When someone's not depressed anymore, you don't keep seeing them for a year to keep them from getting depressed or anxious. So let me see what time it is, because some people are hanging up. Let's see, 12:53. Let's flip really quick through a couple more behavioral ethics and blind spot stuff, and then I'll take questions. And the difference between making a judgment and taking action is significant. Bounded ethicality is when you allow your circumstances to impact your decisions instead of purely ethical principles, like that date I talked about with your significant other. You know, it's a situation that will pull you away from your last visit right on time, even if more is needed. Let's just go to the bottom. I strongly recommend, if you don't already know the work of Daniel Kahneman, I strongly recommend that you look into System 1 and System 2 thinking. The popular book on this is Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. System 1 is the way we operate all the most of the time. System 1, you know, it's cold out, you don't go out and measure the temperature, you don't stand out there and make big decisions about whether to put your coat on. It's System 1 thinking. It's intuitive, it's automatic, it's fast, it's effortless, it's implicit, it's cold out there, put on the coat. That's the way we operate. That's why it doesn't take 45 minutes to get in the car and start it. You run to the car, you turn the key, and off you go. System 2 is slower, it's more conscious, it's more effortful, it's more explicit and logical. When we make mistakes, let's say we are trying to lose 20 pounds. When we don't, it's because System 1 is operating to say, oh, I'm hungry, time to get something to eat, time to go to the refrigerator. And if I make a mistake and violate an ethic, it's because I am thinking, oh, heck, I got to get out of here. It's late. Or when somebody smells like alcohol in my addiction group, my automatic thought is, oh, they'll be okay. I don't need to follow this up. They're talking okay. They're walking fine. You know, I don't want to go into System 2. That's not literal. I'm just saying that we use System 1. It's how we operate as humans. Everything is automatic. I just put my hands under my thighs sitting on my chair because my hands were cold. It's chilly here. I didn't think about that. It was System 1. At this point, giving this talk to you all, fine people. This is mostly System 1. It's stuff I've thought about and been through so much that my System 2 doesn't need to operate. But when we exaggerate how ethical we are and how we wouldn't dare do anything unethical, and we're on automatic pilot System 1, we're at greater risk for making a System 2 kind of to not use System 2 when we need it. And so, in closing, before questions and discussion and goodbyes, and talk to you soon, I hope, in closing, you know, if you want to change from someone who is at a little bit higher risk of making an ethical mistake as an addiction psychologist to become more of somebody who is less likely to make a mistake, step one is to say, you know, I probably do a few things that violate ethics, and I'm going to really give it some thought, and I'm going to intentionally find something, but I'm not going to use System 1 when I'm faced with that situation. I'm going to prepare myself. Next time I'm in that situation, I will be prepared. I'm going to think it out in advance, and I'm going to use System 2 thinking. Time flies when you're having fun. Okay, everyone unmute your phones, and everyone ask questions, and then I'll say goodbye, and we'll contact you again for part two.
Bruce, what would be helpful to... First of all, thank you. This was great.
I hope. You're welcome.
Well, I'm telling you as a fact. It was great. What would be helpful to me, probably on the next call, is if you could go through the process of decision-making around one or two of the examples you gave.
I will. Oh, if you guys look at the entire rest of the handouts, they are all about cases, and that's what we would do in part two, and that's why ethics requirements are always at least 3 hours. And
right.
Mark and I will contact you all, and we'll tell you when part two is. And that is, this is the foundation for part two, and we'll do a little bit of review before part two, and then we'll jump right into going through cases. But this foundation is our first hour, and thank you, Mark, for inviting me to do part two.
Well, thank you for presenting. I think it was we had a lot of people on the line. I want to do a couple
shall
quick
we see
business
if
things.
Should we allow for one question if anyone has?
Yeah, please. Please, why not?
Anyone with 2 minutes left. Mighty quiet group.
Everybody has it on mute, I guess.
That's good enough. All right. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, you probably want to do the second attendance, and the next call is going to be March 9th. It'll be Fred Rogers, who will be presenting on challenges to the brain disease concept of addiction, which
will
be good. Really good. Yeah.
All righty. So I don't know who's still on the line. Let's make sure we get some quick attendance here. If you're doing this for continuing education, please make sure you don't hang up. If you are not, let's just go through this really quick. Mark, you're here. Kevin, are you still online?
Still here.
Tom?
Still here.
Great. Christine?
Thank you.
Amy?
Yep.
Great. Diane?
I'm here. Thanks so much.
Great. Mike Madsen? Mike, you here? Uh-oh. I have to check. Some people might have had to hang up those last few seconds. Alan Budney, one of my favorite people. You there or did you quit on me? Alan, you there? Oh, man. How about Cindy? I know Cindy had to cut out a little bit early. Deborah, you here?
Yes, I am.
Great. And is there anyone I haven't named who has signed up for continuing education?
Yes, Eduardo Morales. I hope you have me down because I've mentioned my name about 5 times already.
Right. There's a formal registration process that you're welcome to do, and you will get credit as long as you're a member, everybody. And so please make sure Mark gives you a link so that you can sign up. All right,
Eduardo, do you have my email address? This is Mark Schenker.
Yeah, I sent you I sent you 2 emails this morning because I noticed it this morning.
Huh.
All right, I'll look for it.
We can now officially kill the
recording. Wait a minute, Bruce,
recording.
I want to say Bookkick is still here.
Hey, Bob.
Yeah, just wanted to say I'm still here, and I am going to sign up for the credit. I didn't as of yet.
It was great to have you. Hey, Mark, make sure you turn off the recording now, because this is of little interest to anyone.
And I'm glad you reminded me.
Good deal. I'll stay on the line in case anybody wants to talk about CEs or anything like that, because I think we have a couple of people.
This is Susan Gillius. I have not registered, but I will do so. But thank you very much. This was wonderful.
Oh, I hope you enjoyed it. I'm glad to have you on board.
Thank you.
This is Rachel
Bassman. Hi, Rachel. Are you there? All right.
I'm still here, but how do you turn off the recording, Bruce? I thought you pressed
9.
1, but that didn't do it.
Do *9 first.
Hey, Bruce, this is Aaron Weiner. I'm here as well. I joined the call a little bit late.